Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, a ruling in former President Trump's Georgia election interference case allows the district attorney to stay on. My exclusive interview with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And the latest on the Israel-Hamas war as hostage talks continue and the first international aid ship reaches Gaza's coast. Welcome to the NewsHour. District Attorney Fani Willis will continue to lead the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump, but the top prosecutor, a man she had a romantic relationship with, is stepping aside. His resignation came after the judge said one of them had to go for the trial to move forward. This development was just one of many this week in the multiple cases against the former president. So we turn again to our William Brangham, who's been covering them all. William, good to see you.
Great to see you.
So the judge in this case basically said to Fani Willis, okay, I'm not removing you, but your lead prosecutor cannot stay on. Help us understand the judge's rationale here.
The judge basically split this right down the middle. This is not what Trump and his lawyers wanted. They wanted Fani Willis taken off the case and the whole case to be dismissed. That is not happening now. McAfee, the judge, Scott McAfee, was very critical of Willis and her behavior. He wrote that that romantic relationship between her and, remember, her hand-picked prosecutor, Nathan Wade, created, quote, the appearance of impropriety and was a, quote, tremendous lapse in judgment. But he wrote that there was no apparent conflict of interest, which is what Trump and his allies had alleged. So judge said, Fani Willis, you and your entire team have to leave or Nathan Wade has to leave. Wade left today, so the case will proceed. So this has definitely left an almost indelible ethical stain on her and her judgment and her office. But it doesn't really change the fundamental legal case that she's brought against Trump and his allies.
So Willis stays on. But on those legal fundamentals, this is the same judge that earlier this week tossed out six of the charges that Willis had filed against Mr. Trump and his associates. What should we know about what happened there?
Right. Trump and his allies argued that there was some vagueness in some of the charges. Remember, this is the case about election interference in Georgia. And these charges involved allegations that Trump and his cohort were pressuring state elections officials to violate their constitutional oaths of office by basically making it so that Joe Biden did not win Georgia when he in fact did. The judge agreed that there was some of that vagueness and he squashed six of those charges. That does leave 30 or something other charges that are part of this much vaster conspiracy indictment that she has brought against Trump and his allies, alleging this vast conspiracy to stop Georgia's votes going to Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. So that case will go forward, but there is no trial date set for that yet.
Okay, I want to ask you about another case. This is the so-called hush money case in New York involving Stormy Daniels. That was supposed to be the trial that went first. It's now been delayed another 30 days. What should we understand about what's happening here?
Yeah, this one really was a bit of a surprise. Just to recap, this is the case that was brought by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, alleging that Stormy Daniels was this former adult actress. She was going to bring a story to light back in 2016 during the campaign. Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, paid her $130,000 to stay quiet about that. That trial and the allegation that they fudged their financial records to hide that payment, that was supposed to start a week from Monday. But now this 30-day delay, why was that delay? It's suddenly because they are now receiving hundreds of thousands of pages of evidence from federal prosecutors in New York. This was part of their 2018 case against Michael Cohen for financial crimes. So the main question here is, why is it that it took federal prosecutors all this time to give up this evidence to the Manhattan DA and to Donald Trump? Because they were asked for this evidence, I believe it was almost a year ago. So many former prosecutors are wondering what the hiccup was here. I talked to one very senior former Department of Justice official from New York. He was quite lacerating in his criticism, calling this an inexcusable lapse. Now, with this delay, that trial probably won't start till the middle of April.
Okay, meanwhile, down in Florida, another case there, that is the one involving former President Trump's handling of classified documents. Trump team this week tried to get that case thrown out. The judge dismissed that. What did she rule?
This is Judge Eileen Cannon. This is the classified documents case that's alleging that Donald Trump basically held all of these classified documents, lied about them, and then obstructed justice. In that investigation, Trump and their team, they've been filing motions in all of their different cases. This is part of their strategy to push all of these trials off as long as possible, to delay them, push them even past the election. In this case, the judge ruled that one of their motions was inexcusable. She said, I think it was the term was that is extraordinary was the word she used. She did leave open the possibility that that motion could be brought back up during trial, but for now, she seemed to express a great deal of skepticism towards the Trump's arguments. So this case is still a very, very long ways away, probably not going to happen before the November election.
William Brangham, thank you so much for staying on top of all of these trials and explaining it all. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
In the day's other headlines, the central U.S. is cleaning up after a string of suspected tornadoes killed at least three people overnight in Ohio. Dozens more were injured. Authorities warned the death toll will likely rise as crews and cadaver dogs search through debris in several states. Lisa Desjardins has the latest.
Oh my God. A terrifying scene for residents in western Ohio.
Oh no.
A tornado tearing through last night. The aftermath is a trail of destruction. Sheared roofs, flattened buildings, and downed power lines, leaving thousands in the dark.
Our laundromat is gone. The old plastics building is just completely demolished. Downtown, it's bad.
The area's hardest hit appeared to be at the junction of three states, in Logan County, Ohio, and the towns of Milton, Kentucky, and Winchester and Selma, Indiana. Emergency management officials say that half the buildings in Selma, a town of about 750, were damaged.
This is the first time anything like this that I can recall has happened in the town of Selma. There's been some that have been close, but never that's impacted the actual town itself.
Tornadoes were suspected across a wide zone, including Illinois and Missouri, in what is now one of the worst storm nights of the year. The National Weather Service tracked more than 300 storm reports, which placed more than 13 million people under a tornado watch. Authorities are now surveying damage and looking for any more survivors.
The devastation was such that we have to get heavy equipment into these areas to be able to move this material where homes have collapsed to see if there's anybody injured. So it's a slow pace. It's going to take a long time.
Residents across the Midwest are shaken.
I was always like, we'll never have a tornado. We got hills. And it just formed right beside my house. I'm like, I never ever thought in 100 years it would have happened again.
There ain't nothing you can do. But it's going to get you. It's going to get you. There ain't nowhere to go here.
Meteorologists warn the severe weather pattern has moved southeast and are watching for strong winds and the potential for more isolated twisters. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
A Russian missile attack on the Ukrainian city of Odessa today killed at least 20 people and injured scores more. The region's governor said the attack hit a residential area. Thick smoke loomed in the air as bodies littered the ground below. In the meantime, the leaders of France, Germany, and Poland met in Berlin and pledged continued support for Ukraine.
Today, we have agreed on a few main issues, and among others, we will acquire even more weapons for Ukraine. We stand closely by Ukraine's side. We've made this clear from the beginning, and this is true for as long as it takes.
A United Nations-backed report today revealed new evidence of Russia's torture of Ukrainian prisoners of war. It says the practices are, quote, horrific and could amount to war crimes. In Russia, elections that are sure to secure another six-year term for President Vladimir Putin are underway. He faces no real opposition and has cracked down on independent media and rights groups. Russians went to the polls to kick off the three-day voting period. Some voters were eager to show support for their country as Russia's war in Ukraine stretches into a third year.
We couldn't miss this election, as we are for Russia after all. We are for the special military operation. Our nephew died, but we believe. We believe victory will be ours, and we are the coolest.
There were at least six reports of vandalism at polling places, including a firebombing in St. Petersburg that was caught on surveillance camera. Back in this country, White House counsel Ed Siskel sent a letter to House Speaker Mike Johnson urging him to end the impeachment inquiry into President Biden. In 6 months, House Republicans have not been able to substantiate claims that the president benefited from his family's foreign business dealings. Siskel wrote, quote, "There's too much important work to be done for the American people to continue wasting time on this charade." An independent commission investigating October's mass shooting in Maine has determined that the sheriff's office had reason to take the gunman into protective custody before the rampage. 18 people were killed that day in Lewiston. The gunman, an Army reservist, died of a self-inflicted gunshot. His family and fellow service members had raised red flags about his mental health and potential for violence prior to the shootings. McDonald's restaurants are coming back online after experiencing a system outage that disrupted operations around the world. The fast food giant said the issue was caused by a third-party technology provider and was not a cyber attack. McDonald's has about 40,000 restaurants worldwide. More than 14,000 of those are here in the U.S. The National Association of Realtors has agreed to cut its real estate commissions to settle a wave of lawsuits. The group will also pay $418 million in damages over the next 4 years. If approved by a federal court, the deal could drive down housing costs, since home sellers would no longer have to pay agents around 6% in commissions. And on Wall Street today, stocks gave up more ground amid concerns about persistent inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 191 points to close at 38,715. The NASDAQ fell 155 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 33. Still to come on the NewsHour, the efforts to put a third-party candidate on the ballot in November's presidential election. A new book explores Jewish people's relationship with God, Israel, and each other. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Immigration continues to be a top issue this election year. And following our reporting from the southern border this week, we're joined now by the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me, Amna.
I want to begin with what we found in our reporting over these last few days in southern Mexico and the U.S.-Mexico border. If you take a look at this map, this is one of the things that struck us. We spoke to dozens of people along the way who were planning on making their way to the United States. This is a list of their countries of origin that were all represented both down in southern Mexico and up at the U.S.-Mexico border. Some countries people might expect, El Salvador, Guatemala, and so on, but also people from Senegal, Mauritania, China, Bangladesh. And we know as those folks make their way to the U.S. southern border, those encounter numbers have been rising. If you look at the trend over the last 3 years, we were seeing record highs. Fiscal year 21, 1.73 million, up to 2.37 million in 22, and finally 2.47 million in 23. Now, we know the administration has been weighing executive action under some kind of presidential authority that could bring those numbers down by restricting asylum access if people enter illegally. Will the president take that executive action?
A couple points, very importantly, that what we are experiencing at the southern border is reflective of what the world is experiencing. The largest number of displaced people around the world since World War II, if not before then. And so we mention the different nationalities of the individuals arriving at our border. That is what other countries across the Atlantic are experiencing and around the world, number one. Number two, the answer is exactly what the bipartisan group of senators presented to Congress, and that is legislation that provides for much needed fixes to what everyone agrees is a broken system and much needed resources to implement those fixes. Legislation is what is needed. That is what is enduring. Executive actions in the past have been challenged in the court, and executive actions without the accompanying resources will not meet the moment.
But absent congressional action, because we know that that bill did not have a path forward in the Republican-led House, absent congressional action, does the president have authority? There is a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act that says he can suspend entry if he finds that entry of migrants is, quote unquote, detrimental to the United States. Should he use that authority to bring down those numbers that you know are taxing resources in our system?
We have not given up on Congress in terms of its ability to actually fulfill its responsibility to the American people. We are always considering what we as an administration can do in the shadow of Congress's failure to act, but we continue to believe that Congress must and can act. We must have them deliver the solution rather than live with the problem.
So no presidential action imminent.
I am not in a position to talk about the deliberative process. I can share with you that we deliberate each and every day how we can address the challenges that we confront. We hope that Congress does the same, meets the moment, and passes the legislation that was bipartisan in nature.
I have to ask you, because House Republicans moved very quickly to impeach you on the basis of those numbers we just saw. That was nearly a month ago. They have yet to send those impeachment articles to the Senate. Has it been communicated to you when or if a trial might move forward?
It has not. And I will tell you, Amna, as I have said repeatedly, I am focused on the work. And the work includes the very challenge about which we speak now, and that is the challenge of an unprecedented level of worldwide migration from which our hemisphere is not excluded.
You've previously indicated, though, on that point, you would be willing to testify if there was a trial. Is that still the case?
I will honor my obligations under the law, as I have done every single day for 22 years in my federal public service.
Related to immigration, we have been seeing a rising number of people fleeing Haiti in a downward spiral into violence in that nation. The head of the U.S. Southern Command, General Laura Richardson, said yesterday that U.S. forces at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba are prepared to accept migrants from Haiti if they start to flee en masse. That would essentially mean U.S. officials intercepting them by sea before they reach the United States and taking them to Gitmo. Is the United States prepared to do that?
Earlier this week, Amna, we interdicted a vessel at sea, and we repatriated 65 Haitians to Haiti. This is an incredibly important message for the people of Haiti to hear, and that is one cannot take to the seas. It is far too perilous. We have seen too much tragedy. The world is focused on the instability in Haiti. We are very focused. We have plans for it. We have contingency plans. But the danger of the journey to the sea is something that an individual should not undertake.
Mr. Secretary, many will say, how can the U.S. send people back to Haiti, already the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, undergoing incredible amounts of violence right now? That journey on the sea was probably the best option in those people's mind. Why repatriate them now?
I would respectfully disagree that it is the best option. We are not insensitive to the challenges that Haiti is suffering and that the people of Haiti are suffering. It is not throughout the entire country, but certainly most acute in certain parts of it. And we are watching the situation and working with our international partners to address it each and every day.
I want to ask you about what several intelligence leaders have said recently when talking about the global threats and the growing threat to America at this moment. The NORTHCOM commander, General Guillot, said recently that the likelihood of significant terrorist attack in the homeland has almost certainly increased since the beginning of the Israel-Hamas conflict. FBI Director Chris Wray said we've seen a veritable rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations calling for attacks against the U.S. in a way we haven't seen in a long, long time. DNI Avril Haines has said, while it's too early to tell, it's likely the Gaza crisis will have a generational impact on terrorism. Do you agree with their assessments that this war has made the U.S. less safe?
We are in a heightened threat environment. We have remarkable people throughout the federal government in partnership with our state and local law enforcement to ensure the safety and security of the American people. It is incontrovertible that we are in a heightened threat environment. I have spoken of this to Congress and publicly as well. They are absolutely right. It demands vigilance on the part of the federal government, all levels of government, as well as the American people themselves.
And to be clear, is that heightened threat environment because of this war?
The terrorist attacks of October 7th and the continuing conflict in the Middle East certainly has exacerbated the situation and heightened the threat landscape.
I want to ask you briefly about a law that was enacted way back after 9/11, Section 702, that allows the government to collect communications of foreigners abroad targeted for intelligence purposes. It expired in December. Congress has basically punted an extension into next month. It's now stalled in the Republican-led House. Are Americans less safe if lawmakers fail to renew 702?
Yes.
Do you see that happening, the renewal?
I am hopeful that they will meet their obligation to give us the tools to protect the American people. And 702 is a vitally important tool. There are other tools that we have that also are extended from time to time, and we endure periods of uncertainty whether we will maintain those tools. It is unacceptable. Our ability to use our counter-drone capabilities when the technology around drones, their utilization by our adversaries is only increasing. We have to have that counter-drone authority, and yet it is extended on short-term each and every time. We have to be equipped with the tools that are useful in the protection of the American people.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Mr. Secretary, thank you. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anna.
Today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced he had approved plans to assault Rafah in southern Gaza, where more than half of all Gazans have fled. But that warning arrived as Netanyahu and international mediators also acknowledged that negotiations for a ceasefire had advanced. Nick Schifrin is here now to break it all down. Nick, good to see you.
Thanks, Amma.
So let's begin with that plan for Rafah. What do we know?
So Netanyahu met first with his war cabinet and the larger security cabinet. You see them right there. And they approved a plan to assault Rafah and move the majority of Gazans out. Now, they didn't release any details, but you can see the problem right there. More than half of all of the Strip is living in Rafah. And the military earlier this week said they would move to, quote, humanitarian islands. Again, no details of what that actually means. Now, Israeli leaders are unified about the need to go into Rafah because they say Hamas's final four battalions are based there, and they believe that defeating those battalions militarily is the only way to actually win the war. But the U.S., frankly, is deeply skeptical that Israel is ever going to come up with a plan that will actually protect those 1.4 million people in Gaza, as you saw reflected by Secretary of State Tony Blinken today.
We have to see a clear and implementable plan, not only to get civilians out of harm's way, but also to make sure that once out of harm's way, they're appropriately cared for with shelter, with food, with medicine, with clothing. And we've not yet seen such a plan.
But the U.S. also understands that Israel is serious about going into Rafah, and that's what is leading to such a huge push right now to try and get that ceasefire done.
And the negotiations for that ceasefire, we mentioned they do seem to be moving along. Where do they stand?
So Hamas has submitted a counterproposal to the latest Israeli and international proposal, and a regional official tells me that it actually advances in two significant aspects. The fact that Hamas is now asking that the permanent ceasefire can be negotiated after the first round of release of hostages. They have been saying that that permanent part of the ceasefire needs to be guaranteed before they released any hostages. And Hamas is willing to release female Israeli soldier. Now, the overall framework for the negotiation is, as we've been reporting, Hamas would release 35 to 40 female elderly and sick hostages. In return, Israel would cease fire for 6 weeks, increase humanitarian aid into Gaza, and release release Palestinian detainees. Now, where the two sides still have gaps, Israel is objecting to the number of Palestinian detainees that Hamas is demanding, and they are rejecting Hamas's desire for how Gaza residents would return to their homes in the north. Now, publicly, Netanyahu is calling Hamas's demands, quote, unrealistic and ridiculous, but the fact is that he's sending his negotiators to Doha to continue negotiations this weekend.
Nick, meanwhile, all of this is unfolding during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. What does that mean for how negotiators, how people here in Washington and the Arab allies are working towards a ceasefire?
They are looking at one fact, and that is that the UN says one quarter of Gaza is on the brink of famine. It is the humanitarian crisis that is really leading these efforts. And there has been a big increase to try and get humanitarian aid in, especially this week, perhaps most publicly by ship. Just today, a World Central Kitchen ship landed in Gaza, delivering 200 tons of rice, flour, and other food. Another ship is right behind it. The U.S. dropped its 11th airdrop of food today. But international organizations say there is no replacement for trucks. Hundreds and hundreds of humanitarian aid trucks need to get into Gaza, they say. Now, Israel says there are no restrictions on trucks, and they blame the lack of aid on UN capacity. But those international organizations are blaming Israeli restrictions. And that lack of aid, of course, also that 30,000 death toll, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry, is really pushing for international pressure on Netanyahu. And that international pressure here in the U.S. perhaps crescendoed yesterday. We saw in the Senate, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer calling for new elections in Israel, saying that Netanyahu had, quote, lost his way. And today, President Biden essentially endorsed Schumer's call.
I had a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him, but by many Americans.
Netanyahu's allies were furious about Schumer's speech. Likud, Netanyahu's party, even had to say, quote, Israel is not a banana republic. But the fact is that Israeli polls are saying that the majority of Israelis want early elections. And if they were held today, Netanyahu would lose. Congressional officials tell me that Schumer's speech basically gives President Biden a little bit of top cover among people who are traditional supporters of Israel if the president decides to finally condition military aid, which his aides say is a possibility. But it depends, Amna, on what we've been talking about, how much humanitarian aid gets in, those ceasefire talks, and, of course, what Israel does in Rafah.
High stakes and a lot of moving parts. Nick Schifrin, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And remember, on our YouTube channel, our PBS News Weekly digital show takes a closer look this week at the latest in the Israel-Hamas war. With the rematch between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump officially set, third-party candidates and well-funded organizations are attempting to carve out their own paths. Jeff Bennett recently took a closer look.
No third-party or independent candidate has received more than 19% of the vote in modern history. Still, the effort to field an alternative ticket is underway. White House correspondent Laura Barrón-López has been following all of this and joins us now. So, Laura, remind us who these third-party candidates are and which ones are actually gaining traction.
Right. Let's go through the list, Jeff. So first we have of the independents, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West. Then when it comes to potential third parties, no labels. They don't have a candidate yet. Green Party. Candidate is to be determined. Libertarian Party. The candidate is also to be determined. But when it comes to them getting ballot access, a number of them are. So currently, there is at least one third party or independent candidate from that list that I mentioned on the ballot in 44 states so far. But when you take a look at the battleground states that will ultimately be the states that determine this election, a third party candidate is on the ballot in all seven of those battleground states, Jeff.
Of the candidates you mentioned, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is arguably the best known. What kind of progress is he making?
RFK Jr. Has been receiving about 19% of voter support in the polls so far. And he's pulling right now in those polls from both President Biden and former President Donald Trump. He's expected to announce a vice presidential candidate on March 26th in Oakland. He's struggled to get on a number of the ballots across states, but despite that, Democrats really see him as a threat to their candidate more so than Republicans do. The Democratic National Committee is heavily focusing on RFK Jr. right now because they see him, as you said, this candidate with the biggest name ID, the Kennedy name behind him. And they are going to be highlighting over and over again the conspiracy theories that he has embraced, whether that's saying that chemicals in the water turn people transgender or his big anti-vaccine platform, which, again, there's no evidence there, Jeff, that vaccines are harmful to people or of his any other conspiracy theories.
We've seen the political group No Label spend a lot of money trying to field their own candidate. They still don't have a ticket. Where does that stand?
This week, they selected a nominating committee to pick that presidential candidate, which they said they aim to pick by April. And when I talked to No Labels, they said they aren't doing this because they want to be a spoiler, that they're doing this because of the fact that they see two candidates, leading candidates, that have low approval rating. But they push back on the accusations against them that this is simply a spoiler effort.
The idea that any of us are going to put our careers on the line and our reputations on the line so we can be part of a shadow effort to help Donald Trump is a joke. That's not what this is about. What this is about is providing a choice to the public that both parties absolutely refuse to provide.
Still, Jeff, after starting this effort nearly 2 years ago, No Labels has not been able to find a presidential candidate. And some of their leading contenders, like former Republican governor of Maryland Larry Hogan and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, have said that they have no interest in mounting a third-party bid.
It seems to be the Democrats, Laura, who are most concerned about a third-party candidate siphoning off votes from President Biden. How are Democrats in the Biden campaign responding to this?
Democrats are reacting to this in a way that they never have before, Jeff. They say that they're not going to make the same mistakes that were made in 2016. And the Democratic National Committee has a team dedicated to combating a third-party threat now. There was a new super PAC called Clear Choice that was launched by Biden allies to also confront this. And then there's this these Democratic outside groups across the spectrum, whether it's the progressives at Move On or the more moderate Democrats at Third Way, that are really trying to tackle this. And they say that ultimately, right now, their focus is on trying to persuade potential high-profile candidates that may mount a bid to not do so. But come summer, they are going to be heavily focused on educating voters about what they say is the big threat of a third-party candidacy.
If they throw away their vote and cast it for a third-party candidate who has no hope of winning, they are, in essence, helping Donald Trump, because Trump has no way of winning a two-way race. He cannot get anywhere close to 50% of the vote, but he can win a multi-candidate race if people throw away their votes and vote for people like Kennedy. But between Kennedy and No Labels and the others, there is an enormous risk.
Jeff, that risk that Matt Bennett is talking about is something that the Biden campaign is well aware of. But right now, Biden advisors say that they are heavily focused on making this a binary choice. They just want to present to voters that this race is ultimately between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Now, if we see come summer that a viable or a potential third-party candidate can pose a significant threat to President Joe Biden, then sources close to Biden world tell me that you could very well see the Biden campaign or other Democratic groups start to push out testimonials from voters that voted in 2016 for a Green Party candidate like Jill Stein and then saw that sway the ultimate result in key states like Michigan and Wisconsin.
That's an interesting strategy. How are voters responding to all of this right now? Are any of these candidates actually making headway among general election voters?
I've talked to some potential swing voters in states like Arizona who say that they're curious about a third-party candidacy or an independent candidate. Sarah Longwell, a Republican pollster who does focus groups with a number of independent and swing voters, says that some voters have expressed concern that a third-party or independent candidate may not be totally realistic.
If I could only pick between Trump and Biden, I would go Biden. But if there's other people out there, I'm definitely going to look at them. However, I also feel like a lot of times it's a throwaway vote, then maybe Trump would get in.
I think that No Labels thing is very idealist. Like, oh, wouldn't this be nice to have kind of a moderate ticket? Not pragmatic. It's not, we always complain about the two-party system, but there's no way to beat it.
Still, Longwell told me that a lot of GOP voters who voted for Nikki Haley in the Republican primary, which are voters that President Joe Biden is going to be targeting, that they are potentially susceptible to a third party candidate, especially if it's a Republican that's leading that ticket. And again, Jeff, as you well know, that could have a significant impact at the margins in those battleground states.
Yeah, absolutely. Laura Barrón-López, thanks as always for that great reporting.
Thank you.
From drafting Iraq's constitution to testifying in the 2019 impeachment inquiry into former President Donald Trump, Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman has dived deep into the intersection of power and ethics. In his latest work, Feldman turns that focus on his own Jewish faith to understand identity, politics, and culture, even in the midst of Israel's war in Gaza. I recently spoke with Feldman about his new book, To Be a Jew Today. Noah Feldman, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So when asking the central question of your book, what it means to be a Jew today, you ask if there's one unifying Jewish theological worldview, and you write this, quote, "I want to suggest it's possible to characterize Jewishness in the way the Bible explains the meaning of the name Israel, to strive, struggle, and contend with God." Tell us more about what that struggle means.
You know, that passage comes from the moment when the character Jacob wrestles all night with a figure who is very shadowy. It might be an angel, it might be God himself, and somehow survives it, and he gets rewarded by being given the name Israel. But that name is not an unmitigated blessing. You know, it suggests not that everything is going to be great all the time, but that he's capable of struggling with the hardest things. And I think that's really characteristic of what it is to be Jewish.
Much of your book is in search of these unifying views, the things that tie Jews together. But at the same time, as we speak here, we are seeing real division among American Jews in particular over Israel's war in Gaza in response to the Hamas October 7th attacks. What does that division say to you about Jewish identity or identities, more accurately, today?
I think it says two things. The first is that over the last 30 or 40 years, Israel has become really central to the identity and thought world of almost all American Jews, even for Jews who are very critical of Israel, and even in some cases to the point of rejecting Israel altogether. They still have to define, they find that they have to define in some relationship to Israel. And that wasn't always the case. The other thing, though, is that there is something that unifies different Jews who have different perspectives on Israel. And that is that a lot of Jews in the United States today, especially Jews who would identify as progressive in their politics and in their Jewishness, really believe deep in their hearts that to be Jewish is to embrace the ideal of social justice, to embrace the prophetic ideal of pursuing the right and the good. And in some cases, they might even think that the whole idea of Israel is incompatible with social justice and equality for Palestinians. And so their unifying religious belief in God as a God of social justice or in a spirit of social justice leads those different Jews to different conclusions about Israel.
You know, at the same time, even before October 7th, we were seeing rising anti-Semitism globally. In a recent piece for Time, you examined what you call really the persistence of anti-Semitism, a more complicated, subtle form as you describe it today. And you write, anti-Semitism's capacity to keep its familiar character while also channeling new fears is what confers its stunning capacity to reinvent itself. What does that mean? What form does anti-Semitism take today?
What I mean is that anti-Semitism has always grown out of a given society's preoccupations, fears, and concerns at a given moment. So, you know, if you were living in the 1800s and the big struggle was the struggle between capitalism and communism, and everyone was very worried about that, anti-Semites either depicted Judaism as the most capitalist or the most communist, depending on which one they didn't like. And they were projecting their concerns and fears onto Jews, and in an anti-Semitic way. Today, a lot of our preoccupations, especially among people to the left, and they're important things to care a lot about, are about oppression, systemic racism, imperialism, colonialism, these are very important issues that deserve serious scrutiny. But sometimes unconsciously, we might find ourselves projecting those worries onto Jews generally, and then depicting Jews in general as oppressors or as white supremacists or as settler colonialists. And although there are forms of those kinds of arguments that could be made without any conscious anti-Semitism, I was trying to argue in that piece that sometimes those unconscious traditions of projecting the worst thing you can think of onto the Jews can inflect and shape our thinking. And they make us forget that Jews today are, you know, just 75 years, a little bit more than that, past the Holocaust, in which Jews were murdered and oppressed, and that before that, Jews were themselves subject to systemic oppression for centuries, for millennia, really. And so, although that doesn't make it impossible to criticize Jews or to criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic, you should be able to do that. At the same time, it's worth taking a deep breath and introspecting and asking yourself, are my criticisms fully free of those older kinds of prejudices?
You know, there are moments in the book when you speak very plainly and very directly to your readers. There's one element that resonated with me in particular when you talk about the idea of being a quote-unquote bad Jew. And you wrote, quote, "It makes me sad when often in a rueful, gentle self-mockery, Jewish friends of mine say to themselves, I'm a bad Jew. They aren't. You aren't. There are so many ways to be Jewish," you write. Why was that important for you to stress?
You know, it was so important to me, Amna, to make the point that there is no such thing as a bad Jew. I think the reason is that, you know, in the whole great tradition of Jewish thought, you can sin and you can do something that's wrong and you can be punished for it or called to account for it, but you're never treated as though you're not a Jew anymore or as though you've, you know, crossed the line into being a bad Jew. You could be a bad person for doing bad things, but you can't really be a bad Jew per se. And so when people say, and they're usually kind of joking around, oh, I'm such a bad Jew because I didn't do this or I didn't do that, I want to say to them, as long as you're striving, as long as you're trying to figure out what makes you a Jew, as long as you have love for other Jews, love for the spiritual and the divine, even if you don't believe in it, then you're being a good Jew. You're doing just fine. And you're just exercising some irony and some self-recognition. And in that sense, you're being as Jewish as you could possibly be, because you're, you know, you're just casting a skeptical eye on yourself and being a little bit funny about it.
The author is Noah Feldman. The book is called To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. Thank you so much for joining us. Really such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me, Amna. I really appreciate your questions.
For more on immigration, how it could affect the race for the White House, and other political issues shaping the week, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Good, as always, to see you both. Happy Friday. Well, let's begin with the conversation I just had with Secretary Mayorkas and this issue of immigration. It's top on voters' mind. We know Republicans want to continue to make it an election issue. Jonathan, President Biden could take executive action. There are options available to him to issue harsh restrictions, potentially be challenged in the courts over them. But as you heard Secretary Mayorkas say, they won't do that. They want Congress to act. Should President Biden take that action and take the issue off the table?
But it depends on whether you want the president to engage in theater or you want the president to actually do something that can help solve the problem. Theater would be signing executive action, knowing full well that it will, lots of people are going to sue. It will get enjoined, probably by the same federal judge who enjoined the Trump administration. And then the problem is where it's always been. Or Congress could do the work it's already done. There is a Senate bill ready to go, a bipartisan bill negotiated by, I think the secretary was at the table, Senator Lankford of Oklahoma was the lead negotiator. Democrats were at the table. There's a bill there, but nothing's happened. Nothing's happened because Donald Trump said don't do it, even though the bill has everything in it that Republicans have been demanding for years. key among those things, though, from the secretary's point of view, I would think, is the money. The money that would be made available to Homeland Security to hire the personnel and the staff needed to deal with asylum cases, to deal with the crossings over the border. If Republicans, if the American people really want something done at the border, they would demand that Congress pass the Senate bill.
David, do you see Congress taking any action on this? Or do you think President Biden should, as Jonathan said, just take the theatrical step there and sign an executive order to say he's doing what he can?
Yeah, I think he should sign the executive orders. You know, there are certain things I think he could do, remain in Mexico, maybe more security. The money's certainly a problem. But he's taken executive action on all sorts of issues like student debt relief. And so I think this would be a good, just politically, a very good thing to take some action. You know, Jonathan's colleague, David Ignatius, had a very good column about a month ago about Mallorca. And he made the point that in the early days of the Biden administration, Biden wanted to be anti-Trump on the immigration issue. Everything Trump was for, he was going to be against. So there was a moratorium on deportments, deportations. There was, you know, all sorts of other measures. There was going to get away the Remain in Mexico, so where they have the hearings in Mexico and not in the U.S. And so they really went in sort of in a leftward direction. Mayorkas was trying to fight this the whole time. And now the administration is pinioned, and he's left hanging out by the Republicans. So ideally, I agree with Jonathan that Congress would pass that bill that gave Republicans like 60 or 70% of what they wanted. But in absence of that, since Donald Trump's against it, it's not going to happen. I just think it's imperative politically for Joe Biden to do something and see what happens in the courts.
David, while I have you too, I need you to ask about House Republicans' effort to try to impeach Secretary Mayorkas, which seems stalled now. They haven't moved anywhere on it in nearly a month. Was it a mistake, and should they take a political loss on this?
Well, I think they should. It was meritless. Mike Gallagher, a Republican congressman who voted against impeachment, made the point, you know, we don't impeach people over policy disagreements. And they had differences of opinion, and Mayorkas made some statement that they thought, some Republicans thought were untrue. But these are not impeachable offense. They really have no case at all. And so, you know, I just think it should go away.
Jonathan, let's move on now to something Nick Schifrin was reporting earlier, which is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer issuing a very sharp critique of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Thursday on the Senate floor, basically calling for a new Israeli government and saying in part this.
I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel.
Jonathan, you interviewed the president last week. You asked him about his red lines. Has a red line with Netanyahu now been crossed?
I think so. If you take Majority Leader Schumer's incredible speech, put that on top of what the president told me last week, which was, yes, if Netanyahu crosses over into Rafah, that would be a red line for him. Add that on top of the now very vocal opposition to Netanyahu that's been coming from the administration, from the Secretary of State and other senior officials in the administration. We are seeing a widening break, not between the United States and Israel, but between the United States and Prime Minister Netanyahu, who the Biden administration from the president on down view as an obstacle, not just to peace, but to some sort of resolution to what's happening in the Israel-Hamas war, but especially a resolution to the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Gaza.
David, how big a shift is this in the U.S. approach?
For Chuck Schumer, it's pretty big. He's very pro-Israel. And so I do think it's a big shift. I agree with everything he said about Bibi Netanyahu. I still think he shouldn't have said it. He shouldn't have certainly have said it that way. A, it's just not becoming to try to interfere in another democracy's electoral process, especially if you're a major figure in the American election. Second, I worry about how it's being received by Hamas. So Hamas's strategy is to get as many Palestinians killed as possible and hoping that the ensuing outrage is going to cause the international community to crack down on Israel, and Israel will have to relent. And they see Chuck Schumer doing that, and they think, which they already think, which is they're winning. And frankly, when they see what President Biden told to Jonathan about the red line, it was a little fuzzy the way he said it. Was he against a Rafah invasion, or only if the Israelis don't really improve their humanitarian record. But if he's against the, Rafah, any kind of incursion into Rafah, as Benny Gantz, the defense secretary of Israel, said, when you're fighting a fire, you can't only fight 80% of the fire. And the hostages and a significant chunk of Hamas forces are in Rafah. And if you let them win, if you let them stay there, there will never be a two-state solution, because there will never be a two-state solution as long as Hamas is in power. And so I mostly worry about the dynamic on the spiritual battlefield where Hamas suddenly feels emboldened.
The only thing, though, here is if Netanyahu goes into Rafah, my question is, where do all the Palestinians go? These are the same, a lot of them, the same Palestinians who were in the north who were told to go south because of the bombings and everything that was happening in the north. And the bombings have followed them. So if you invade Rafah, where do they go? And I've not heard a response to that question.
This is the question that remains. I do want to move on and get both of you to weigh in on many of the events we saw that have to do with the race for the White House and the big election ahead. It's not terribly surprising, but it was a big moment. Both President Biden and former President Trump have now officially clinched the nominations, reached the delegate count they needed. You saw Laura reported earlier on the efforts to mount a third-party candidate and how it could dramatically alter the landscape. Jonathan, I want to ask you about that, because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues to poll in double digits, 15-20%. He's now on the ballot in some 15 states. Are Democrats worried that he could siphon enough Biden votes to make a difference?
I mean, third-party candidacy is just, they tire me. Now, the fact that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is getting that much support and is on the ballot in that many states would concern me. But I wonder, is he going to take from President Biden, or is he going to take from Donald Trump, especially if he puts on Aaron Rodgers? And if he does that, look, if a third party can...
To clarify for voters, to catch them up, by the way, for viewers, yes. Aaron Rodgers has been reported as a potential vice presidential pick. Okay.
Right. And so if you are serious about running a third party candidacy, you should be serious about the people you are thinking of having as your vice president. Aaron Rodgers, it should not be taken seriously. It just feels like a jumping the shark moment, as opposed to a serious effort to try to win the presidency. So, look, I have every confidence that the Biden campaign can handle a third party challenge in any of the states in 24. I just think if he does actually make a ticket, they're going to fizzle out. I just feel it in my bones.
David, what do you make of this? Because let's remind folks, both candidates here have frustrations among their voting bases. Both have their weaknesses. As Laura reported, someone like RFK Jr. could siphon votes from both. But how do you look at it?
Yeah, I think the no labels thing will fizzle out because they won't have a high profile person. I don't think Robert Kennedy is going to fizzle out. We've got a country where, you know, a tiny percentage of people think we're headed in the right direction, and where the two candidates are unprecedentedly unpopular. And so I do think Kennedy is going to linger around there, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 percentage points in some of these states. And all I observe is that the Democrats right now are more alarmed than the Republicans. And the Democrats are going to a lot more degrees to try to keep him off the ballots and to try to keep him off. I, too, am confused about who he'll end up hurting. Right now, he seems to hurt Biden more, but that's because what people know about Robert Kennedy is the word Kennedy. As his views get out more, they might know, oh, he was against the vaccine, and that suddenly a lot of Trump voters might go on to his side. So it's really a mystery of who he'll help and hurt.
David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, always good to see you both. Thank you so much. And be sure to tune into Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight on PBS, guest hosted by our own Laura Barrón-López, for a look at how congressional leaders are affecting President Biden's foreign policy and the latest on Donald Trump's legal battles. And on PBS News Weekend with John Yang, we examine the safety and reliability of helicopters after a string of fatal crashes. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.